So I'm Scott Hanselman, and this is a tour of .NET 4. I try to show you as much cool stuff in .NET 4 as possible in a little bit of time that we have. I think we have about 75 minutes, right? Before we start, I want to talk about some of the sad things that happened during the process of creating Visual Studio. I know that there was some layoffs and some people were let go. They lost their jobs, like this guy. Crazy pinched face guy with his tiny eyes. To save money, we replaced him with a cheaper guy. And we also got rid of this guy because, I mean, has anyone ever seen a programmer this pretty? No, it's total. Well, maybe. Maybe once or twice. All right. So do you guys remember these days? Oh, look, there I am again. Hello, me. Ah! I can't win. Keep my hand there? I think I might become Jewish just because of this. So, you guys remember these days, right? And then you remember these days, right? The dark times. We were all there during these times. And then we remember this. You're welcome. This is the wedding cake of .NET. I think we've all had that conversation with our bosses at some point where it's like, all right, well, we're going to go from .NET 2 to .NET 3, boss. Oh, well, it's not really a change. It's just additional libraries, right? No, trust me. Well, but then 3.5 is really .NET 2, but it's 3.0 plus 3.5 plus some libraries. But .NET 2 is actually side by side with using the same CLR. Right? We've had that conversation with our bosses, right? I'm sorry. I did not do that. It's not my fault. Don't blame me. It's been confusing, and I think we all understand that the layer cake there was entirely a marketing kind of naming decision, okay? So in .NET 4, we're side by side. We're trying to, is it like Steam here? You see this? Was there a rave earlier? Did I miss something out? That's great. I know it's not Amsterdam, but there's a lot of smoke in this room. Suddenly there's a coffee shop on stage here. I don't know what's going on. I hope it's not going to affect my performance. .NET 4 is side-by-side. This means that you can install .NET 4 on your machines and it won't break your existing apps. It's side-by-side. So if you remember going from 1.1 to 2.0 and you understand how you can have, for example, in IIS, multiple app pools, different app pools with different versions of .NET, the same thing is the case in .NET 4. If I bring up IIS here, let's go ahead and, like, video guy, let's get me off the screen there. It's freaking me out that I'm looking at myself from behind here. Let's focus on the code here. So this is IIS. Maybe he didn't hear me. Here in IIS, you can see I've got a classic .NET app pool that's .NET 2. I've got one that's .NET 4. I can have as many of these as I want. I could have 1.1, 2.0, 3, 3.5, 4, all running on the same machine. So 4.0 isn't going to break anything that you already have. I'll show you some more cool side-by-side stuff in a little bit. The other thing is that we're not going to automatically bring your code forward without asking. Even though it's a very compatible release and like 95% of the code that you have will probably just work if it ran underneath .NET 4, there were some things that because it's a side-by-side release, that we can break. We can make some fixes that are better fixes, but they're breaking changes. So we won't bring you forward unless you opt in, unless you decide to be on .NET 4. Now, you remember these days? This is a beautiful website in, 1994. A lot of tables there, a lot of tiny one-pixel GIFs. If you want your applications to look a little bit more like this, you want a lot of control over your markup. There's a bunch of new changes in ASP.NET 4, and this is including web forms. A lot of people put web forms down because they say they don't have enough control over their markup. All of the controls, a lot of even the older controls in ASP.NET 4 have been updated so that you can spit out ULs and LIs instead of tables. You can also specify client IDs on the controls. So rather than getting an auto-generated control that's like, you know, nested control underscore table underscore da-da-da-da-da, which makes it very, very difficult to talk to your controls using JavaScript like jQuery, and it also bloats your HTML. You have the ability to set the client ID mode to static or what we call predictable. So you can just say like control 1, control 2, control 3. Little subtle things like that. There's literally dozens of fixes inside of ASP.NET 4 to make life easier, including the removal of the need to use CSS adapters and make things a lot cleaner. If you are a web forms person and you know a lot about web forms, you're productive in web forms, and you're not quite ready to move over to MVC, but the most attractive aspect of MVC is the ability for you to make clean HTML, you can stick with the web forms that you like and make good, clean, semantic HTML without having to switch over. There's also a bunch of view state improvements. View state is smaller. It can be disabled on a page level, on an app level, or it can be just turned on a per control level. So view state is really a minimal problem. Lots of other small changes like cache extensibility. There's a new object cache. You saw in the MVC talk, if you were there, we've got a syntax to automatically HTML encode. So you can say colon instead of equals, and that'll give you the equivalent of HTML.encode. There's also a bunch of deployment stuff. If you go to my blog or you check out live.visitmix.com, I did a talk at Mix a couple of weeks ago that was called "If You're Using Xcopy, You're Doing It Wrong." And I go through a really detailed scenario on how to use deployment. I really believe that if you're deploying your web applications with two Explorer windows and some dude has to drag a folder from one to the other, or if you're using FileZilla to deploy your web apps, stop doing it. Check out the web deployment talk that I did at Mix. I swear it'll change your life. It'll allow you to deploy databases, set ACLs, hook up certs. If your deployment consists of FTPing something and then sending a Word document to an IT person with screenshots of what the checkboxes are that you want them to click in IIS, stop and use the new deployment stuff in 2010. It's pretty fantastic. So I want to show you an interesting demo. This is something that I kind of came up with yesterday. I wanted to show a couple of things. There was a gentleman who stopped me in the hall yesterday who wanted to know about whether he should pick MVC or web forms. And I said, well, you don't really have to decide. Even though the file new project dialog box feels like a fork in the road, it feels like you're forced to choose. I want MVC or web forms, and once you've picked your vocation, once you've picked your choice, you're screwed. You can't back up. So I said I would make a hybrid application for him to show that you can have one ASP.NET site, one site that can be MVC and web forms. It can have web services in it. It can have JSON services all in the same place. Plus, I also wanted to kind of bring up the issue that people say that maybe MVC isn't productive enough and I can't get stuff out of MVC, and why do I need web forms anymore? So I've got this little web application here. And all I added to it initially was Northwind. I apologize. I made a Northwind EDMX model. Very basic stuff. I just drug the database in and boom, Northwind. It's what I had lying around. Please forgive me. This is my home controller here. And all I did was just put the Northwind in my controller. This is an ASP.NET MVC controller right here. And then here under... Let's do list. Under list, I'm just going to say var products equals db.products.toList. And then I'll say return view products. So I'm going to pass that list of products there. Here I've got details. It takes an ID. We'll say var product equals db.products where something, Lambda Magic, Anders, that's what I call that. That's Lambda Magic Anders, is, by the way, is what that's called. I think he's left, though, right? He's not behind me, is he? Equals ID, oops, ID dot single. We grab that product, and we would pass it in here. So I'm going to grab a specific product for that particular details. Then I'll come over to my views. I'm going to say add view. We'll make a list view. It'll be a strongly typed view that's of type product. We'll say list. Hit add. Da-da-da, magic, magic. Add view details. Magic, magic. Add. So there I've got my products. Let's bring this, let's just run this. This is MVC still. La, la, la. MVC. Database, database. Hard drive, blah, blah, blah. So here's my list from MVC. And then there's a details page that kind of got auto-generated. So you can be very productive, of course, with MVC. But I can also go and do something like, from within my MVC application, I'm going to say add new item. And I'm going to just select web form using master page, and I'll make a products page. And I'll select a master. And then I'm going to switch to split screen. And then bust out the toolbox. And then I'll come down here and I'll grab an entity data source. I'm going to click Configure Data Source, pick my Northwind connection, Next, grab Products, click Enable Inserts, Enable Updates, Enable Deletes, hit Finish, then I'll grab a grid view, I'll collect an entity data source, enable paging, enable sorting, enable editing, enable deleting, enable selection, auto format, brown sugar, hit OK. You can see, of course, the split screen's updating. And then I'm going to go here into the global ASAX where I set my routing. This is my default MVC routing. And I'm going to say routes.mapPageRoute. We'll call it products. And we'll say other list. And the physical file will be products.aspx. And I'll run this. And it will fail. And then I will be sad. Ah, darn, /backslash thing. So now I'm running my app. Here's my MVC list that we saw before. There's my web forms list. I've got selection, I've got editing, I've got deleting, and I can switch back and forth. So there's some MVC and there's some web forms. Web forms list, MVC list. One application. You saw how fast that was. I really want to make sure that you guys get the point that there are things that MVC is good for and there are things that web forms is good for. Yeah, it was cool that I was able to get a details page and a list page up using MVC, and I was able to do that in about the exact same amount of time that it took me to do the grid and web forms. But when I did the grid and web forms, of course, I got sorting, editing, deleting, paging. It's not necessarily pretty because I picked a silly color, but I think you get the point. It's all in one application. But notice the URL for the web forms. See how it doesn't say products.aspx? It says other list. You can have hybrids. Pick the right tool for the job. You know, codeplex.com, it's a hybrid. ASP.NET 4 is kind of greater than the sum of its parts. You shouldn't think about MVC as one world and web forms as another world. You can have these things together. I could then add other services to this, WCF services, Azimex services, in one application. Pick the tool that's right for the job. And if you like to do things this way, you can see that it's nice and clean and productive. If you like to do things this way, you can do them, same application. It's a really nice way to start moving your apps in the direction that you want without having to sacrifice what you're already used to using. Hopefully you like that. All right. Briefly, I want to talk about OData, and this used to be called Astoria. And this stuff is a little bit confusing, but there's basically WCF services you've used before, right? WCF services used to be called Indigo many, many years ago. WCF services is our web services stack, so that's things like WS security and what they call WS star dot star. It's message-based web services. WCF data services is the name of this thing that was called Astoria in the past. So WCF services, Indigo, message-based web services. WCF data services, formerly Astoria, is resource-based web services. It's based on a thing called Atom and Atom Pub. You guys are familiar with Stack Overflow, perhaps? I'll just show you very briefly. Stack Overflow. It's a question and answer site run by Jeff Atwood and Joel Spolsky. It's pretty cool. They release a dump of data on a regular basis. It's like this big torrent of XML. And I wanted to make it available via what I thought was maybe a cleaner API. So I took their dump of data, which is a big XML file, and I imported it into a SQL Server. And you have things like posts, and posts have comments, and users have badges, and we've got this nice entity model. So I imported their stuff into a bunch of database tables, and I dragged these tables onto the surface, and now I've got these entities. So an OData service allows you to just take a type of data service and make it of type some class. In this case, I just took those entities, the ones from that data service, and I made them available to this OData service. This could be anything. It could be, you know, could be people service. It could be, you know, my array of stuff. Anything that has I queryable objects. Anything that allows you to query objects using link. There's nothing else in here. It's just taking all of the public stuff inside of this entities and making it available. So it's making comments, badges, posts, all of those tables are being exposed. So what it looks like is this. You show up to a service file and you see these hrefs. See, an href is a thing that we're familiar with. This would be a relative href, href posts. So I could type in posts. And it looks like a feed. It looks like RSS. It's because it's based on Atom, which is a feed language. See, it's a W3C standard. And then we add some namespaces, and we bring data back. Here's posts at 4. Here's someone asking a question about some kind of a repository. Let's see here. Find some interesting question. In SQL Server, when should you split your primary data group into a bunch of files? So this is posts at 6. See right there? Posts at 6. So now I can go directly to that. The title is there. I could say posts at 6 slash title. Posts at slick at 6 slash title $ value. See the difference there? See the URL? WCF services is message-based. So if I were going to make web services calls to get data from something like Stack Overflow, I would say, like, I would make a SOAP file, you know, I'd make a SOAP message. I'd make some WSDL, and I would say something like get post request. And I would post the SOAP get post request message, and I'd have to define that, and I'd get back the get post response message, and I'd have to parse that. Da, 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 da. And I would have used SOAPscope or any number of different WCF-based tools to do that kind of stuff. Resource-based data access doesn't lend itself to web services very well. So now we've got a balance. We've got WCF services for messages. And for messages, I think of things like transactional stuff. As a person who used to work in online banking, I think of things like transfer money, you know, make credit transfer or, you know, initiate loan. Those are like messages that I would use a WCF service for. But WCF Data Services, which is an implementation of OData, is a formalization of the ability to talk to resources using the existing verbs that we have in HTTP. We've already got gets, posts, puts, and deletes. And get, post, put, and delete map very nicely to create, read, update, and delete. So you can do CRUD over data resources like this. So because their data model at Stack Overflow was so clean, it was really, really easy to do this. And you can see that it's very regular, and I can just browse it with the web browser here. But I can also use tools like LinkPad, which is a fantastic tool, linkpad.net. If you don't use this for your regular link work, just like stop, stand up, walk out of here, and go download LinkPad. It's that good. In LinkPad, I can go and say add connection. I can use link to SQL, but I can also point it to a WCF data service. So I pointed it to my service here. Now it's talking over the wire. It just did an HTTP call, and it got that list. You remember that list of services that we did before. And now I can do link queries like this. The same kind of link queries that you're used to from pnposts. I'm going to go and get all the SQL Server-based things. And I say execute, and then that data comes back inside of this link pad in a nice table. But what did it really do? Service posts, substring SQL of title, substring SQL Server of tags. It's link to REST, almost, or link to URL. It took that same link structure that you would ordinarily talk to a database. Now it's talking to the web. So I think OData is a really, 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 really cool thing that you want to keep an eye out for. And you may already have resource-based data that's available to you, and you want to make that available to other people. And WCF existing services have not really lent themselves to the kind of work that you want to do. I would encourage you to check them out. And I can have those things live in the exact same file. I can have ASP.NET applications that talk to them. I can also have JavaScript talk to it, or PHP, or Java, or whatever. OData is an open format. You go to odata.org. Now, this JavaScript here is a couple of weeks old. This is being changed, so what I'm showing you here is out of date. But you may have heard that we're contributing some code to the jQuery project to do client-side templating. This is some JavaScript, not C#, to be clear. This is JavaScript that's going to go call an OData service. It's going to go and get some information. It's going to get the top 20, order by first name, and then expand out orders for those customers while they're at it. So if I run this, there's going to be a pause, and then the data will come back. I'm going to just show you that again. That right there was what was sent across the wire. Just the header was sent across the wire. If I do a view source, there's the header, table, title, first name, last name. This here, notice that that's not data. That's just an expression of some data binding. This comes across, this page comes over onto the client side, then JavaScript and jQuery makes a call back to a service and then merges the data together on the client side. And this actually is a master detail. I can even go in and give this guy a middle name and hit update, move around inside of this nice grid. It feels like an active ASP.NET application, doesn't it? But take a look at this. It's just static HTML. There's no ASP.NET involved at all. So if this is how much functionality you can get just using JavaScript and static HTML, think about if you start merging in web forms and MVC plus OData. You can start to get some really, really interesting stuff. You might go and create an OData service, a WCF data service for your site, and just expose it to the community so they can you can have a free API, or you might go and do it and consume it for your own usage. You take a look at the nerddinner.com site. Over here in the corner, I've got an RSS feed, I've got an iCal feed. That right there is an OData feed. So if you want more OData to play with, you want more services to talk to and practice queries and learn about why this would be interesting, take a look at the source code for NerdDinner. I've updated it to MVC2 and .NET 4, and this one application has jQuery, it has iCal, it has RSS, it has OData, lots and lots of different pieces of the framework, each of which just using a couple of lines of code. So I'd encourage you to check that out. Okay, it's a tour, right? So bear with me because we're moving around. There's a lot of stuff in WPF 4. There's all sorts of Windows 7 support for things. There's a new data grid. There's a new ribbon. You know, I always joke about WPF because it's just like Visual Basic 6, except now with angle brackets and you only need a gig of video RAM. And, of course, you can make things 3D and they can glow. That's how I usually describe WPF to people. One of the things about WPF that was a problem a little while back, where did that go, was a lack of clarity. You would look at stuff in WPF and you'd find that it was really blurry. There's one of my favorite applications out there is called Evernote. And Evernote is like OneNote. It's run by a different company. But the text is a little blurry. Rendering of fonts and stuff in WPF has been a problem. You can always kind of smell a WPF application. I mean, I think some people are nodding because they had really high hopes and then they ran their app and it seemed wrong. It seemed blurry. It seemed out of focus because their font rendering was different. Well, there's been a number of changes in WPF. And you've probably figured out or heard by now that Visual Studio itself and the editor is using WPF and all the menus are doing WPF. And a lot of people don't really realize that, but it's very fast, it's hardware accelerated, it's very clean, and it's not blurry. They've put so much work into this that I found this to be very interesting. On that top line there, the first line is some text on 2008. The middle line is 2010 release candidate, and then, which is what you guys have, and then the RTM version will have a new fix to make text even clearer. Can you see the difference between the second line and the first line? It's really, really subtle. It just feels a little brighter, doesn't it? It feels like a little bit of a kick. But for some people who perceive color in certain ways, that just is like really irritating. It freaks them out. So when the RC of 2010 came out, a bunch of people who used dark themes inside of Visual Studio, dark colored code, just said, it looks wrong. I hate it. And they figured out by looking like at the sub pixels that they were hinting slightly different. Like if you look at the eye, see the color? It's just a little bit different. They're just making different choices. Well, the cool part is that the top is 2008. The bottom is 2010 RTM. Can you see the difference between those? You can't because they're not. There's no difference. They've really, really put a lot of effort into this. So you won't be able to tell a WPF application from any other application. And the text is going to be crystal clear, which is really, really cool. And again, Visual Studio itself is using WPF. So as a fan of WPF, I'm really, really glad that they got this right. There's a side-by-side of some code in 2008 and some code in 2010. So let me show you a WPF application that is a favorite application of mine. This is an application for someone to run a used car organization, like someone that was selling a lot of cars. They had a lot of inventory of cars. And in this example, there's like 200,000 different kinds of cars. In the original version of this, we got to use the names of real car companies. Like we had like BMW and Ferrari and all that kind of stuff. Except they said that legal said we can't do that. So I don't even know if I can tell you that, but it was all the cool car companies. So now we had to change it to like lame pretend car companies, like Contoso Automotive and Tailspin Motorsport, but pretend that they're real cars because it was cooler before when you could see the Audi logo. You see that yellow, 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 yellow? Let me do that one more time. Query, 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 query. It's populating that. It took about 3 seconds to do that query. There's an interface called iCarQuery. This interface called iCarQuery, and it has the name, the description, and the image, and all the results. And each one of those boxes is a different query. So here's a Litware limousines, and then there's the query. Four C in cars, where the price is this much, and the year is that. It's a pretty typical kind of a thing. But you can see that it's implementing iCarQuery. And there's a bunch of these. So those are the queries that appear together. And then all we're doing is spinning through a list of them for each query in car queries. All right? But where is car queries? Well, car queries is right here. It's sitting inside my application, and it says public collection of car queries. And they are of type iCarQuery. But there's no line of code anywhere in this application that says car queries equals something. There's just this property here. Nowhere do I assign that car queries. This is using a thing called MEF, Managed Extensibility Framework. And this is a library for composition. It allows applications to be dynamically composed, kind of like you dynamically compose your computer now by plugging in USB stuff. The idea is that you want to open your application for extension, but you don't necessarily want to modify its behavior. It's the open-closed principle. And the idea is this. It's a dating service for components. You guys have like a dating service? Like here in the States, everybody meets people on Match.com. Is there like a Match.nl or something like that? Is it okay to meet people? Because maybe like 10 years ago, it was creepy to meet people online. And now apparently it's creepy to not meet people online. You didn't meet them online? What's wrong with you? This is a dating service for components. This component here has an attribute on it on line 22 that says import many. This is the, you know, man seeking woman, or in this case, many. See, that's where the analogy kind of breaks down. But this property is making a declaration that it wants iCar queries, and many of them. And it doesn't really care where it gets them. And all you have to do is say import. Now the queries say export, woman seeking man, one. Export. This is simply a declaration of availability on the part of this component. He's just saying, I'm available. He's out there in the world. But he's not really in a catalog yet. He's just declared his availability to the world. And each of these queries has that export. So what MEF lets you do is this little bit of magic here. And I think this is really cool. This is not dependency injection. It's a formalization of a composition model. We've all written plugins before. You go and you implement I something plugin, and then you say for each assembly in this folder, load the assembly, assembly.load, try to cast it to the certain interface, and if it works, make a collection, blah, 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 blah. Right? We've all done that kind of boring monkey code before. But it's harder than you would think, and it's tedious, and you end up loading assemblies into memory that you don't need. Sometimes you want to have detection about whether or not an assembly has left. You want to unload assemblies. Things get really, really complicated. Here, we simply say, I want to make an aggregate catalog. I want to build a catalog of all the people who are or components who are interested in dating. I want to make an aggregate, so it's a catalog of catalogs. And it's going to consist of two locations. One, the current directory, directory catalog. And then two, assembly catalog using the currently executing assembly. So I'm going to look for people who are interested in meeting each other in two places, the current directory and the executing assembly. I'm going to take those people, I'm going to put them in an aggregated catalog, and then I'm going to stick them in a composition container, kind of like in a bowl, and shake them up. And then we're going to go and ask for values. When we do the composition, it happens application-wide. So when this person says, get exported value, he can ask for something. He could say, iCar query. He could say, iFoo. He's basically saying, go look in that catalog for this thing, and then it'll do the composition for everyone. What that means is, I want to stress this again, there is nowhere in the application where someone says car queries equals. By the time this object gets created, that property is automatically populated. That's really cool. You can think about how you could start composing applications like that. So what I can do then is I can take this C# application, I'll come down here, and I've got another little project, except this one's in VB, just to make the point. And this Visual Basic one is an iCar query, and he has an export as well. And he introduces a new kind of vehicle. He's got motorcycles, and he's got some link as well. And then what we can do, I'm going to shut this guy down. I'm going to right-click here and say open in Explorer. I'll come down here, I'll right-click, and I'll say open in Explorer. And I'll use my little... They should make like a sound effect for that. And there's a bunch of sound effects that don't exist in Windows, but I am going to make them happen. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring up their bin folders. Okay, over here is my Contoso Automotive EXE. And over here is my extension. I've also got my PDBs and my XML, but just to make the point, I'll just copy over the DLL. One time I did this demo and I copied over like three files and they wanted to know what these were. One of them is the generated help and the other one is the debug file. That's all. And then I'll just run this. And now Woodgrove Cycles appears next to it. So we've dynamically composed the application. We've changed the way that it works and that it looks. This is the kind of stuff that you see in Outlook. Outlook's a good example of a composable UI. Visual Studio is a really good example of a composable UI. A lot of the stuff that plugs into Visual Studio 2010 is using MEF as its composability model. What's cool about MEF is that even though it's open source and it's out there in CodePlex and you can get it, it's also built into .NET 4. So MEF is out there now for you to use, and you don't have to do anything. It's in .NET 4. It's available. It's part of the component model. Now, this took now 4 seconds, so I added the Woodgrove Cycles component, and it's getting slower. Well, it makes sense why it's getting slower. It's because I'm going for each over that, and it's going to get slower if I add even more. I am using something that's part of the task parallel library, though, because I wanted to do that in the background. One of the big things in .NET 4 is this notion of the parallel computing initiative, the idea that doing threading is hard, right? You know, because just be straight. Everyone here is probably smart enough to go and write some threading code, but I doubt that you do it for fun. And I doubt that when your boss in the suit tells you that you get excited and you're like, yeah, rock on, I can totally do that, boss. There's a problem now in that the suit can say something as a requirement, as a business requirement, and it's a very short sentence. Except those suits that say very short sentences turn into 40, 80, 100 hours of work. Hey, programmer guy, I'm the suit now. This is great, but you know the UI locks up when I do the query. Can you just run it in another thread? That didn't take very long to say, but it's going to take a while to code. Threading is one of those kind of things where we learn about it in university and we know how to do it. Oh, can you take a picture? Oh, I missed the action pose. We learn about it in school, except to do it is a big deal. We could probably, you know, Google around and figure out how to do it, but then there's other things. There's concurrency. Well, now I've got it running in the background, but how do I cancel it? How do I detect when someone hit the cancel button? You know, what if it, you know, what kind of coordination needs to be done between things that are running in the background? Concurrency for the masses says let the developers solve the business problem, not the concurrency problem. This is a picture that I found on Flickr that's really cool. It's for a patent application for a new kind of needle. If threading is hard, redesign the needle. You push on the top and the needle bends open, makes the eye really big, then you put the thread through and then it goes like that. I thought that was a really cool idea. I don't know if it's possible, but it's sure neat. If threading is hard, redesign the needle. And this is kind of what that attempts to do. There's a number of features. There's the task parallel library, which I'll show you. There's a thing called parallel link. There's some coordination data structures that make coordinating between threads easier, because it's always challenging to find out about, well, am I on the UI thread or am I on another thread, and how do I let something that happened on the UI thread notify something that's happening on a background thread? And then there's a number of other improvements to system.threading as well. Let me switch over here. Task factory start new does just that. It says, hey, go and fire up a new task on a background thread. And then everything inside from here to down here. Oh, apparently I'm I think I'm on my fourth 30-day trial, and pretty soon Ballmer's going to knock my door down and I'm going to have to write him a check right there. Everything from here to here. This is a little subtle. You see how when I clicked, by the way, on the curly brace, that it turned gray and then it lit up the one at the bottom there? There's a bunch of little subtle things like that inside of Visual Studio 2010. See how I just clicked on query and then the word query appeared? It lit up in two places. When you have local variables like that, it'll find them and match them up. So I said, make a new task and then take this chunk and run that off somewhere else. Except I might hit cancel. So I've got a cancel button. Where's my stop? La 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 la. We've got this search operation thing, which is called a cancellation token source. When I click the cancel button, I just call cancel on this search operation variable. This is a special thing. It lives inside of system.threading. Cancellation token source is something that's smart about living on multiple threads. That token search operation is something I can look at. So in the middle of this for loop, I can just query and say, is cancellation requested? I'm not having to do anything about is it on the right thread or do any checks. I just say, hey, should I stop? And then this here, I want to point out that that's actually all one line, right? This is where that line ends. When it's finished, when that background task is done, I say, continue with this chunk of code. This is a really, really common pattern. Start a background task, let me know if it cancels so I can do something about it, and then when you're done, do this. So in this example, I hit search, it fires off a background task, and then when it's done, it enables search. Because when I click search, the first thing I do is disable that button. right? So I can't click it twice. And then when it's done, I turn it back on. This makes that language that the suit asked for closer to what the code would look like. Except it's still slow. It's 4 seconds. And I've got a multiprocessor machine here. I've got a dual proc machine. And when we run this thing, it's only using 50% of my processor to do the work. I've got the other processor just kind of hanging out. So what I can do is I can run the queries in parallel. Take a look at line 86. We've replaced the for loop with a parallel for loop. This is part of the parallel library. Parallel for each, query.run. And I put some timing in there on lines 84 and line 90 to say, you know, just to tell the time, but that doesn't have anything to do with the stuff. And then we've got the search operation continue with. So there's a couple things going on here. We still have it running on the background. So the UI is responsive. It runs in the background, and then from the background, it fans out again onto multiple processors. This is what they call delightfully parallel. And what that means is there's no reason to not run these things on multiple threads. They're not, you know, they don't need to be coordinated. There's not a parallelism problem there that requires deep coordination. If you're doing a for loop over 200,000 of something, just break them off and do two for loops over 100,000 somethings. You know, figure it out. Another word for it is embarrassingly parallel, where there's just really no reason for you not to do it that way. And this is all built into .NET 4. So let me run this thing in parallel. Notice my processor is 100%. It went from 4 seconds to about 2 seconds. Watch the yellow outlines of those plugins. You see that? You see the difference? Here's sequential. Here's parallel. It's almost a 2x speed up. I think that's a pretty cool example. I like this demo a lot because it shows a bunch of stuff. It shows MEF. I'm bringing plugins in. I'm enlisting those plugins into a larger operation, in this case a for loop. When I added the new plugin, it gets involved as well. I'm running them on a background task so that the UI doesn't become unresponsive. So when I'm running this thing, see, I could still move things around. It's not unresponsive. It doesn't give me that kind of curtain of I don't know, whatever, that veil of I'm not responding that happens to Windows applications sometimes. And then when another plugin gets involved, it's going to utilize more processors. It'll use as many as I've got. I've actually got control over how many of those that I want to allow. I'll show you another really great example. The kind of parallelism that you want to do sometimes is where you've got like a link query. Just a regular link query like the ones that I've been showing during the entire conference, except I just want to make them parallel. I can go and add as parallel at the end of that from P and people as parallel. And then I can even go and say dot with degree of parallelism and say we'll only use half of the processors. Maybe I've got an 8 proc machine and I only want to have this happen on 4. You have explicit control over this stuff. This is a application that was a demo that I came up with for the guys. And you guys know the theory that if you have an infinite number of monkeys and an infinite number of typewriters, that those monkeys will eventually slap the typewriter and write Shakespeare. So that's a computationally interesting problem. So what we've got here is generations of monkeys. So each monkey has a baby, and that monkey inherits the traits of the parent and becomes a better typist. So if the monkey is a better typist, we let him live. And we're breeding superior monkeys. But we're doing it in a parallel way, right? So we've got, so far we've had 2,300 generations of monkeys, and we're doing 50 generations a second. And they're trying to write the Shakespeare that's on the right. And you see how they're getting better on the left there as they slap the type, as they slap the keyboard. So monkeys are living and dying and slapping the keyboard and living and dying. It's really quite a horrible, horrible and morbid, morbid demo. And it slows down towards the end because some of these monkeys just don't get the idea, like slings and arrows. He's just insisting on spelling it wrong. But this is the kind of thing where it's really about the algorithm. So imagine that you were given this job to figure this out, right? And you'd go read a bunch of books, and you'd figure out the whole algorithm, and you'd do all the for loops and all the magic. And then the boss says, oh, you know, you have an 8-processor machine, so just run it on all 8. And think about how suddenly the problem stops being about monkeys and starts being about managing 8 processors. That's hard. That's really hard. So what the Parallel Computing Initiative, what the stuff the folks are doing in .NET 4 is trying to enable is to put you one layer away from the parallelism problem. Find the common patterns of parallelism that you will have to come upon in your everyday life and then make them available to you as tools. There is literally no excuse anymore for us to not run something in the background or run something in parallel. Use those multiprocessor machines. Think about the existing applications that you've got that do delightfully parallel. That's the marketing term. Embarrassingly parallel type stuff, you know, for each. And think about how you can make that faster. Looks like they misspelled end and suffer. Monkeys, 8,000 generations of monkeys, and they can't get this right. Come on, monkey. You can't spell suffer? The A and the S are right next to each other on the keyboard. You can do it, monkey. This is interesting. The A here is next to the S, and then the S here is next to the D. And they just can't get those two right. Thousands of monkeys are dying to, well, theoretical monkeys. I wonder if it could actually get into a state where it will never, like a million years of monkeys, and they'll just never learn the difference between an A and an S. I only have 75 minutes, you're right. Let's all watch this. This is not a waste of your time at all, is it? Each person here, €100 an hour, do the math, right? This is like a $500,000 operation as we check out how to get these damn monkeys to do their freaking jobs. Oh, he got suffer. Oh, my God. He got that one right. Da, 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 da. Monkey, monkey. Ah, monkey, monkey. You realize, I want to tell you something, actually. You know the little scoring system that they've got here with the stars and stuff? I was doing pretty well, and then suddenly, like, someone's giving me ones, and like, you're number one. And then the stars are getting really low on the rating system. You know what it is? Every time I do this, I, like, lose a star. That's what happens with the system here at DevDays. Like, that's not content. Why do you keep doing that? That's not cute. You're not funny, Hanselman. But I'm not bitter. It's okay. All right, well, it looks like that monkey is not going to get that. I'm going to wait. Ah! He did it. Yay, monkey. All right, don't feel it. Don't give me your pity applause. I don't want that. That's okay. No, no, no. No, screw you guys. Forget you and your pity applause for my trained monkeys. All right. Really, really useful thing to point out about a lot of this stuff is that you've probably heard about these different initiatives for years. You've heard about MEF because Glenn and the MEF team have been doing that work out in the open. You've heard about ASP.NET MVC. But one of the things that, so some people say, well, some of the stuff in .NET 4 isn't new because I've been hearing about it for so long. But the thing to point out and the thing that you should go back to your bosses and say is that it's all built in now. I don't have to go and download stuff from CodePlex every time I want to do something interesting. It's just baked in. It's nice to be able to say that those things are out of the box. Now, Anders showed some stuff on the DLR, I'm sure, but I missed it. So I'm going to talk about the DLR. The Dynamic Language Runtime is a library that's sitting on top of the CLR, and it's providing a lot of different pieces of information that the CLR can't do ordinarily. The CLR doesn't intensely know about expression trees, and it can't do dynamic dispatch. And when it does do dynamic dispatch, it can't do call site caching. The DLR enables those things, and I'll talk about what each of them is very briefly. People usually talk about dynamic programming in the context of these other languages, using things like the Python binder to have C-sharp talk to Python, or to have C-sharp talk to Ruby, so that Ruby objects can talk to C-sharp, and C-sharp can talk to Ruby objects, VB, yada, yada, yada. But the really interesting thing is the business scenarios that dynamic languages enable. It's fun to talk about Python and Ruby, but there's a bunch of stuff that you can do, like in COM. If anyone here does work in Word and Excel and automating those things, you always feel when you're talking to the Word automation model or the Excel automation model that it's not really .NET. COM and its yuckiness leaks out. And there are things about COM with iDispatch that were very much dynamic language type constructs. The dynamic language runtime, sure, it enables languages like IronPython and Ruby, but it also does some really amazing stuff with Office that I'll show you as well. First, let us switch over to here. And I'll show you the IronPython stuff. Bow, 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 bow. So I've got a bunch of Python sitting in a folder. And this is written by really smart people. And the reason that I know that to be the case is that when I opened up this particular file, this random.py, and I was scrolling through this with my community college degree, I noticed that the people who wrote this would actually refer to books and pages within books while writing a function. Now, I've been a professional developer for 18 years, and I have never referred to a book from 1977 in my code by page. I'm not one of those people who plays chess with you and you move your one pawn and I go, oh yes, the Fibonacci defense. This is the programmer equivalent of that. Never go up against a Sicilian when death is on the line. This person must have a PhD. They just must. Because I don't have any idea how this works. Oh, of course, it used Cheng. I prefer the 1978 revision of Cheng's applied statistics, but, you know, if he can use the 77, the initial version, you know, it's fine. But I'm just a stupid .NET programmer, so I'm just going to assume that that works, but I want to use it. I don't want to learn Python. So what I'll do is I'm going to fire up Python, say python.createRuntime, and then I'm going to say python.useFile. I'm going to just use that random.py. And then it's going to generate some matrix of random numbers. And notice that I'm actually going to call random.shuffle. Shuffle is actually the method that we're going to call. And I'm going to pass in a .NET object. So I'm actually passing in an array, a .NET array. Now here's the cool part. I've got this type called dynamic. But remember that C-sharp is a statically typed language, which means that you have to tell it the type up front. So when I ask people, how do I explain this? How do I explain dynamic? The guy says, oh, well, it's statically typed as dynamic. Blood leaking out of my ear at that point. Statically typed as dynamic. So, of course, that doesn't make any sense at all. But tooltips are nice. So I hover over it, and it says, represents an object whose operations will be resolved at runtime. That makes sense. Represents an object whose operations will be resolved at runtime. So what would happen if I come down here to random, and I hit dot? Am I going to get IntelliSense? Anyone want to guess on that? No. But I will get a friendly tooltip. This operation will be resolved at runtime. Cool, rock on. No, it's okay, that's okay. Compiles. Oops, misspelled. Does it compile? Well, it must work, right? It compiled. Compilation. Static, you know, you have this the whole static language, dynamic language argument, but compilation is just the first unit test. If we had like a Gandhi of .NET, You know, someone who could like come in on a pillow and sit like with their legs like that, they would say stuff like that. Compilation is simply the first unit test. Right? Oh my God, that's amazing. He is so wise. Oh, statically typed as dynamic. Wow, I'm going to meditate on that. That's deep, though. I've had huge arguments with people who have been telling me how important it is that we use a statically typed language because you know ahead of time that it's going to work, right? Because if you get that red squiggly, somehow that provides you some value. Now, I don't speak Dutch, but I could go into Word and I could tell Word that I'm writing a Dutch application and enable the Dutch dictionary. And I could write out an entire document, and through a lot of effort, I could get that document to have no red squigglies. And I could give it to you guys. And I'd be like, hey, it compiled. There's no red squigglies. I speak Dutch. Awesome. Right? And then you would turn on the grammar checker, and it would be full of green squigglies, and it would actually say nothing at all. It would be complete nonsense. Compilation is no more useful than spell check is useful. It just tells you that you got the syntax right. It doesn't tell you that you expressed your intent right. So when I see things like the dynamic keyword, and I hear people talking about how this is a horrific perversion of C#, and the world is ending, and cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria, it's not that big of a deal. Because if you don't have a unit test to back it up, it doesn't matter. Is this going to work? Of course it's not going to work. But there's no way for the compiler to know that. It's just that much more important when you're doing dynamic stuff that you do it with some unit tests. So now I can go and call that Python function from C#, and it just works. Yay, that's cool. So that's DLR. It's not the end of the world, and it's not var. Right? Remember, var is the I'm too lazy to type it, you figure it out. And dynamic is the we'll never know, let's run it and see. I'm so glad that Anders has left the building and he's not like, what are you saying to those people? That is just wrong. He wouldn't say it like that, but it would be similar. It would be very similar to that. All right. Now, remember I was talking about Office. In Office, how many people do Office interop work, make, you know, have to do stuff like that? Okay, I'm sorry, it sucks, but it's a job, right? So feel good that you have work. No, seriously though, Office interop is cool. I actually worked for a company in 1994, SQL Server 4.21, VB3, I think, maybe. Word 6 had just come out, NT351, and it was called Carfax or something. And basically people would call and say, I want information on this Volkswagen or whatever. And we would fax them a sheet with all the details. All the model, make, parts, and all that kind of stuff. We had a huge database. It was a massive 50-megabyte database and of car parts and information. They would call in, they'd fill out this application, and then we had a digi board. Remember digi boards? No one here is older than 30, apparently. We had a digi board with like 8 modems all plugged into the thing, and we had 8 megabytes of RAM, and we would basically automate Word. We'd bring up Word and we'd for loop over the car database and we'd make this awesome thing and then we'd print it to a fax that would go out via the digiboard. We had like this array of faxes and you'd call in, you'd order your fax and we'd send it off. And it was magical. And people would do these demos where they would, you know, run the thing and then like theatrically they would raise their hands and slowly back away from the demo, you know, I'm not touching it. The ghost in the machine. And they, oh, that's amazing. It's automation. Ole automation was like God's own hand had reached into my computer when it was slapping the keyboard. It was amazing. And now we're all like, oh, man, Office automation sucks. It's amazing how far we've come in just 18 years. So this application is using some of the features of C# 4 and the dynamic language dispatching to make things cleaner than before. If you look at line 22, when you had to call range, you'd say like get_range and call it like a function, even though it really was kind of a property. But that's how Calm and iDispatch thinks about it. And then you'd say, get Excel range, and you'd say A1, and then you'd have to go and get the value of that. Now, and there's dozens of little things like this. It's just the point here is that we're making it much, much cleaner and much simpler. Now I can refer to that range as appropriately as a hash table and how much cleaner that is. This particular application fires up Excel, goes and does a link query on line 26 and talks to the processes and gets all of the processes that are using a lot of RAM. Then it sticks them into Excel, makes a chart, then it fires up Word, copies that picture into Word, pastes it. And this is all using the automation stuff that's built into these PIAs, primary interop assemblies. Now, in the US, PIA usually stands for something else. It's a pain in the ass. And PIAs are just that. Sometimes you might make like a 5K application like this that does one really small thing, except you have to go and include 20 megabytes of primary interop assemblies. And those interop assemblies contain .NET versions of every single COM type. So every possible thing you could ever do in Word or Excel is inside of that database, that assembly. Let me bring up Reflector. Bum, 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 bum. Reflector. Am I the only person that makes sound effects to myself when... Don't you guys do that? Is that just me? I totally feel that we need more sound effects like that. I do that all the time. It's not just because I'm on stage. If you know me, I'm the same guy when I'm off stage, which is really annoying. Here I've got these references to the interop assemblies. And those interop assemblies are full of just all sorts of crap. Go on for days. I have to bring them along, though. Well, there's a very subtle but new feature inside of 2010 where you can go like this. Embed interop types. And what this does, if you care about this stuff, is really, really cool. Whoop, what happened there? We good? Beep. There you go. I said embed interop types. What that's going to do is it's going to look at my application and the types that I use, and then it's going to use a thing called CLR type equivalents, and it's going to take those types and pull them out of the PIA and bring them into my application. They'll still be the same types, except they don't have that same identity anymore. If I bring up Reflector again, notice that my references are gone, except now I've got Microsoft Office interop namespaces inside my assembly. But inside there are just the couple of types that I use and not the entire 20 megs of PIAs. But you've probably seen this before where if you make a type called foo that's in the bar namespace and then there's another assembly that has the same thing and they don't really line up because they don't have the same identity, they can't be treated as the same. But in this case, the CLR understands the notion of type equivalence, and it can basically dynamically figure out that this chart lines up exactly to that chart. They are effectively the same type. So it's okay that it's running inside of my my world, and I don't have to bring those references along. So for people who are doing this kind of office automation, they can deploy these things without having to bring those PIAs along for them. There's literally like dozens of really cool little things that are built into .NET 4. It's amazing how what you guys will clap at. I've been waiting for a freaking hour and a half. All I got was pity applause for the monkeys. What's wrong with you people? All right, last demo here. Oh, I wanted to show you this real quick, by the way. That top one there, that's a standard call to a calculator object. This is the exact same call using Reflection. Right, we're passing in add because it's dynamic, right? In this case, I could change the word add to subtract and it would still compile, but I wouldn't know until it failed. That makes it a little bit easier if you use some of the scripting support, but it still doesn't quite look right and it's still late bound. You don't really know and it's ugly to look at. That's the same as the top. It's much easier to read. It still compiles. If I misspell add, certainly it's not going to work. But I'd much rather write that kind of code than the reflection kind of code. So the dynamic keyword is more than just interoping with Python and interoping with Office. It's just about making life easier. And I hope that lines up with what Andrew said earlier. It's pretty cool. Type equivalence, that's that thing we just saw where the interop assemblies translate between COM and managed code. Now, .NET 4, like I said before, is highly compatible, which means most of your stuff will just work just fine if you choose to compile it under 4. But we don't auto-roll forward. You have to put in that configuration file switch. Now, this is cool. If you write add-ins to Explorer or to Outlook, you probably know this. If you have a 2.0 CLR inside of your process and you try to get a 1.1 in, it doesn't work. But now, with CLR 4, you can have both .NET 2 and .NET 4 in the same process at the same time. Ding! Let me show you what that looks like. Dun, 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 dun. Control C. Boop. You guys know about that. I did this at Mix. You know, the other couple of actually cool features. You know that you can actually shift right click? Copy as path appears if you shift right click. That was useful. Yeah, that, don't even clap for that. That's just mean, dude. I wasn't involved in that feature at all, dude. bring up this. CD space, Alt space, EP, enter, boom. So, all right. Inside of here, I've got a V2 managed COM DLL, and I've got a V4 managed application. One of the things that I like to do at the command line is freak out young people who think that they understand how, like, you know, DOS and stuff works. So every once in a while, I'll just hit F7 to freak them out. Oh, what the hell is that? You guys know about that? And the guy was like, is that new? Is that in Windows 7? Wow. No, dude, DOS key, circa 1985. Welcome to 1985. F7. Yeah, so V4 managed app. Okay. This little application is a V4 managed app. There's a thing at the command line that you can run. This has always been here called CLR ver. Do you guys know about this? You did? Oh, shoot. I'm looking at this guy who was excited before, but you know, you totally knew about this, right? Yeah, okay. What about, well, you know about that too? Yeah? Oh. Now I feel better. So look at that. CLR ver slash all looks at all the current running tasks and then tells you what version of the framework is running inside which exe. Oh, I could see myself using that, right? You've probably written scripts to do that kind of stuff, or maybe you run Process Explorer and you want to see what's running in .NET. That's cool. So we see V4 managed app is running. Now, this message box is .NET 2. Bam. That's amazing. Wow, thank you, Scott. So if you write plugins and COM plugins and stuff, and you're going to be writing stuff for Outlook, maybe you already have an existing plugin for any of the applications that use COM to fire up .NET, nothing's going to break when you put 4.0 on your machine, which was a huge problem during that 1.1 to 2.0 transition. And I think that's a really cool, cool feature and a cool example. And CLR ver-all is really, really useful to figure out what versions of stuff is running on the machine. So that is all my time. Thank you very much. That was a lap around .NET 4, all of the cool new stuff that's coming. Feel free to follow me on Twitter if you have any questions or email me, and I'll talk to you guys later.